The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
This morning we have four cases, one of which will be presented orally. Three of them will be presented on the record. For purposes of the record, the three cases submitted are 2007-7205, Bailey versus BDA, 2007-1437, Rocky Mountain Tech versus Hutchins Industries, and the third one submitted on the record is 2008-7008, Fowler versus BDA. Cases heard this morning for Civil Tech Computer Associates and Versus Computer Associates International, 2007-1201. Mr. Nelson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. No, 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Newman, you reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal for cross-examination.
That's correct.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do I can't raise issues that have not been raised on direct appeal?
Understood, Your Honor. And can I proceed, Your Honor?
Sure.
Okay.
Are you ready?
With respect to my appeal, I've reserved the 10 minutes partially to deal with the rebuttal to the cross appeal issues as well.
The problem is there's an overlap here. It strikes me that you have a problem in that you are construing terms for infringement differently than you are for invalidity. And in particular, computer system and destination storage medium. For infringement, you say it includes a floppy disk, and for invalidity, you say it doesn't. I mean, how am I supposed to make that?
You're correct, Your Honor. The answer to that is if you reverse the construction with respect to the computer system issue and the destination storage medium, which go hand in hand, then with respect to that issue, an appeal here, that would also need to be reversed. I'm not going to sit here and advocate inconsistent positions to you. There are a couple of other issues that I will address with respect to those separate issues that the district court did not use as a basis for their summary judgment, for the district court summary judgment, but that were argued with respect to that art that I can explore with you, which would be an alternative basis to sustain the summary judgment with respect to that art. With respect to that computer system destination storage medium issue, if you reverse on that and go with our construction, Symantec's construction, then as to those issues on the cross appeal, that those would also
be. We've got to send it back on the issue of invalidity. Okay, so what's the correct construction? Since you are taking two different positions, what's the correct construction of computer system destination storage medium? Does it include a floppy disk or doesn't it?
Under the construction that we proposed below, Symantec proposed below, it would, Your Honor. And that construction, for the record, is any combination of hardware, software, documentation, and manual procedures that have combined to perform a specific function. That can be, a citation would be page 16 of the appendix for that. And that was the construction proposed below for a computer system by Symantec. And that would, so that would include the floppy disk.
So that's the correct construction?
Yes, sir.
With respect to the assets being transferred limitation, you are advocating, I guess, a different meaning than the district court's meaning, which considered assets being transferred as an activity that takes place prior to the time data is being written, as opposed to being stored.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And based on the construction of storage from Hillgrave 2, storage meaning sort of the end of the process when the data is not only written on a hard drive, but is made accessible to the computer, then Even if that construction is binding on us, you would nonetheless argue that as it's being transferred means anything prior to that time.
That is absolutely correct. In fact, what happened here with respect to the in-transit limitation, CA makes two arguments primarily with respect to that. One argument is based upon a misreading, and this is primarily what the district court based their decision on below. It's a misreading of the file history. What the district court said is that the language you just read, a method for screening data as it is being transferred from the preamble, was added independently in order to overcome prior art. That's not correct. That language was added in exactly the same amendment as the language that this court construed in the prior Hillgrave 2 case, which is a method, or in the body of the claim, screening data prior to storage. So,
but there are two different, because there were two different amendments, or two different, there was the prior to storage language added, and there was the as it is being transferred language. Now, the as it is being transferred language is in the preamble. So the question is, well, wait a second. First of all, is it different from prior to storage, or is it not? And second, if it's different, does it mean anything because it's in the preamble? But here's the problem I'm having. It is in the preamble, but it is argued as the basis for patentability. So if there's anything to our doctrine about you give the preamble some weight when it gives life, meaning, and vitality to a claim, what better sign of vitality when you're arguing it as the basis of patentability?
Understood, Your Honor. And what it was, as I said, the other limitations in the body of the claim that specified exactly how you carry out the steps of the method being a method of screening data as it is being transferred, those were added at the same time. And what you have here in the preamble...
Well, they were both added at the same time to overcome the same concern about patentability.
Yeah, correct. It was all part of the same amendment and the same arguments. That's correct. The as it is being transferred is the name of the method. So as you see in the preamble oftentimes, what you do, it's a method of doing X, right? And then you have the steps that carry that out. So when the amendment was made to specify exactly when the transfer began and when it ended, begins when you cause the data to be transferred, transmitted data. In other words, remember the prior art, there were two kinds of prior art that the patent and the specification said this isn't any good. One is when you screen it when it's already on the source computer, and then you do a separate step to transfer. In other words, make sure it doesn't have a virus before you transfer.
So should you initially guard the insert in the preamble?
No.
Is that totally disregarded at this point?
No, I don't. You shouldn't disregard it. That is the name of the method, and the steps tell you exactly when that transfer begins and when that transfer ends. And that's what this court determined before in the prior, when it went through and determined what the invention was and said that this method for screening data as it is being transferred at that point was the endpoint that was at issue, which is the endpoint when it's written to the destination storage medium, or is the endpoint when it's stored? And that was construed to be when it's made accessible to the operating system and the applications, because that's when it can affect the system. That's what this
was being argued over. Mm-hmm. That part scanned for viruses when? After the data or the programs were stored in the sense of Hillgrave 2?
Correct.
There was no prior art that showed scanning during the time data was being written and prior to the time it was made available. The only prior art showed scanning after either scanning before the program was transferred in the first place or after it was stored in the sense of being available to the computer. Correct?
That is correct. That is exactly right.
So there was no reason to argue patentability based on whether the scanning takes place prior to the time you are writing or prior to the time you are storing. As long as it was prior to the time that it was stored, that was enough.
Correct. That is
correct. You're saying this is two sides of the same coin. That in transit happens before storage.
That's exactly right. It's bookended by transferring the data from the source system. In other words, eliminating that prior art that the specification talks about where the scan was done on the source medium and then a separate step was used to send it to the destination computer. And it's ended when that data is made accessible on the operating system. In other words, stored from this court's prior construction in the Hillgrave 2 case.
But if you look at the specification, you can see where the district court might have found room for a different interpretation, because as I read the specification, all of the virus scanning takes place during the screen search, the string search that is depicted by block 32, correct?
In the embodiment?
In the embodiment.
Yes.
So in that sense, this disclosure, limited and schematic as it may be, doesn't show anything that scans after the data is written. And all scanning takes place before anything's written.
In the embodiment that's described, that's rather than using the hard drive itself as the buffer, the receipt buffer, so to speak, which is a more common implementation these days given transfer rates and file sizes and those kinds of things. What the implementation chose back in 1990 was to have a separate RAM buffer in the system in order to do that. But they're both being used in exactly the same way in this instance. And in fact, the specification also in Figure 6, and this is something that we pointed out in the brief, specifically says that the transfer process doesn't end in the specification, that the transfer process does not end until the file is closed and then it's completed and at that point made accessible to the operating system.
But what does on the fly mean? I mean, it sounds like the invention is scanning before anything hits the hard drive.
No, on the fly is a shorthand method for exactly what it was that they were trying to claim, what the inventors were trying to claim to be their invention, which is it's not the prior art where you scan on the destination, or excuse me, the source machine, and then have a separate step for transferring. And it's not the prior art where you scan what's already stored, because those things can already infect the system, right? On the fly in this are the two things in between, and that's what this court determined before in the Hillgrave 2 case when it determined what the invention was and went through and said, because remember the issue before this court twice before was exactly what we have now. There was summary judgment entered by this same district court that said on the basis that the data was written to the hard drive before there was any scanning. It was reversed in Hillgrave 1. Granted, that was on an agreed upon construction. Although the court did say in Hillgrave 1, the invention is a method for screening data prior to storage, i.e. as it is being transferred.
Easy enough to get confused.
Yes. And in Hillgrave 2, the court once again considered the invention and said that and determined when it was that it could infect the system. In other words, this back-end prior art that was trying to be distinguished, why it was that was no good according to the patent and the file wrapper, was because those things are already stored, already made accessible to the operating system, already made accessible to the applications, and therefore they can infect the system. And what the court said is, in Hillgrave 2, is the invention is for scanning in between those two times. Considered an endpoint. As long as we do it prior to storage, that is before the viruses can spread and infect the computer system. So this exact issue, factually speaking, has been determined twice by this court in whether a summary judgment should withstand under these patent claims when the undisputed facts are that data is written to the hard drive but not yet made accessible to the operating system when the scan is done.
Mr. Nelson, you're well in your rebuttal time. You can save some of it?
I would like to save some of it, Your Honor.
We'll restore 7 minutes to your time.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
prosecution history is very clear. The in-transit limitation, streaming the data as it is being transferred, was added in a different part of the claim as the prior to storage. This is what the applicants...
They were added at the same time.
They're at the same time in different parts of the claim.
Why? What's the basis for thinking that they were intended to have different meaning? Why isn't in-transit meaning prior to storage?
This is exactly what the applicant's attorney said. This is at appendix page A7442. He's discussing the prior art. He says, neither of these references address the applicant's objective of transferring data from a source medium to a destination medium virus-free. That can only happen. That objective can only be accomplished one way, if you screen before any piece of data touches the hard drive.
Well, wait a second. Why can't it mean you screen before any piece of data is stored in the sense of Hillgrave 2 that is accessible to the operating system?
Because it wouldn't be in transit screening. If the screen, because
if storage is the demarcation line, if storage is when, that's the time when the computer has access to the data and can possibly be corrupted by the virus. If that's the transition period, then why isn't the transfer period any time prior to that?
Because the applicants argue that the whole goal, whole objective of the invention was preventing the virus from entering the computer in the first place. Now let's look at Matt Gray's
declaration. What do you mean by part of the computer?
The hard drive. And what tells
where
us
does it say that?
What tells us this is Matt Gray's declaration.
Where?
Paragraph 4.
No, 7442, what page?
That is A8363-66. Yes, paragraph 4.
A8363.
Yes, sir.
Okay, which paragraph?
Paragraph 4, Your Honor.
From affecting the computer system in the first place?
That's right. He says, the idea of his invention is to prevent the virus from entering the computer in the first place. And he goes on to say
what
that...
What does that mean, accessible to the operating system?
Let's see what he further says, Your Honor, in that paragraph. He says, a virus enters the computer when it's copied into the system. That's when it's written to the hard drive. That's what it means. And he says that he came up with an algorithm, an in-transit screening algorithm that screens the data before it's copied into the system. And if there's a virus, the data doesn't get copied into the system. That's exactly what it means.
Is there anything else?
Yes, the specification, Your Honor. Every piece of that patent specification, from the name of the patent that says in-transit screening to the abstract that says that you test the data in between a source medium and a destination medium.
Yeah, why isn't that perfectly consistent with in-transit being before it's accessible to the operating system, before storage?
Because taking the word storage in isolation, that could literally mean that it's possible under some circumstances to test the data, to screen the data after it reaches the hard drive, and that's not what this patent says.
Yeah, but that's the question. You're giving an answer, but what's the support for the answer? Where does it indicate that there's a concern about having it written into the hard drive as long as it's not accessible to the operating system?
Column 1, summary of the invention. The patent says you want to prevent the virus from taking up residency on the destination storage unit. How can you do that unless you screen it before it even reaches it?
Well, let me ask but is the destination storage the actual final storage unit?
It's the hard drive.
That's the hard drive.
The hard disk in the computer. The patent says that we don't want that virus taking up residency there. And this is exactly the way the screening method works. It screens bit by bit every piece of data. It screens bit number one. If bit number one doesn't complete a virus signature, it gets written. Bit number two, number three, etc. If any bit that's screened completes a virus signature, it doesn't get written, and everything that was written gets wiped out. Symantec keeps talking about figures 6A through 6C. The patent actually says what those figures mean. In column 6, the last paragraph, going over into column 7, it says, if a virus is detected, the transfer stops. If a virus is not detected, the data gets written to the destination storage medium.
But under your construction of this so-called in-transit limitation, why wouldn't storage be construed to mean when it appears on the hard drive, when it's written into the hard drive? Why wouldn't that be the correct construction of storage? And we rejected exactly that construction of storage in the earlier case.
Because it's a different claim element. It's a different claim element. When the claims say screening the data as it is being transferred and prior to storage, that's exactly the embodiment they disclosed in the patent. The data screened bit by bit before it ever reaches the hard drive, and data that's actually written.
Well, how does the second limitation mean anything if the first limitation says that you've got to do the screening before it gets to the hard drive? Why would there be any concern about the defining storage under those circumstances to mean not that it's written on the hard drive, but that it's accessible to the operating system?
The patentee put those two limitations in there. I can't get inside the attorney's head.
So you're not able to give us an explanation as to why you have those two different definitions?
Well, you can't render the as it is being transferred meaningless. You can't render that claim element meaningless. It was argued as a basis for patentability. It can't mean exactly the same thing as storage.
It wasn't separately argued from the storage limitation, was it?
Yes, it was, in the sense that it says neither of these references address the applicant's objective of transferring data from a source medium to a destination medium virus-free. Okay, something, a virus can be on the destination storage medium, and it still not be stored under this court's definition of storage. But it would not have been screened in transit unless it was screened before it ever reached the storage medium. The specification says that. The only embodiment in the patent shows that. And that's what they argued in the prosecution history.
Well, let me ask you this. The claim says in the preamble, screening the data as it is being transferred.
Yes.
You contend that means prior to the time it's written.
Absolutely.
Then you have, in the body of the claim, receiving and screening the transferred data prior to storage.
That's correct.
Receiving, screening the transferred data. So
right.
Are you screening transferred data, or are you screening data before it's being transferred?
You're screening the data that is in the screening mechanism in the computer, but has not reached the hard drive yet. That's what you're screening.
But you're not storing.
At that point, it's not stored because it's not even on the hard drive.
But it's transferred at that point. It says in the body of the claim, receiving and screening the transferred data.
But not to the hard drive. You have to
transfer to what? The claim is
it's transferred.
It's full of some unusual language that causes problems.
It's transferred to a buffer in which the screening mechanism takes place. Each piece of data is screened. If it passes the test, it goes into a second buffer. That's figure one. It's those blocks of figure one, and then it goes from that buffer onto the hard drive. There is nothing in this patent that shows that data can be screened after it reaches the hard drive. It has to be screened before.
But you're talking about the embodiment, and I agree with you entirely. That's the only embodiment that shows something that, to me, screens bit by bit as it goes along prior to anything being written on the hard drive. But that's an embodiment. So the question is the claim limited to that embodiment? And we're all focusing on this language, transferred and transferred on the fly, and the argument made to overcome the rejection. But if the prior art only showed systems where screening took place after the data was stored, in the sense of build rate too, then then the patentee didn't have to make the argument that the storage took place prior to the time it was written, as long as it was screened prior to the time it was stored. That was enough.
But the patentee made the argument in both the specification, in the summary, and in the file history, that you have to transfer the data to the destination medium virus free. The only way you can do that is to screen it before it ever gets there.
But didn't suggest that there were two separate limitations here, which is what you're saying. You're saying that on the one hand, it has to be screened before it's put onto the hard drive, and then you're saying there's a second limitation that has to be screened before it's accessible to the operating system. That second limitation has no meaning given your construction of the first limitation.
Well, prior to storage, the in-transit limitation would not have any meaning, because that means if the whole claim was subsumed by the word storage, you could have data being screened after it's on the hard drive.
Well, what's so unusual about having a preamble which states the same thing as the body of the claim, which is what seems to be the case here, that they're saying it has to be screened in transit as a preamble, and then in the body of the claim it says prior to storage. Why does that suggest that those are the same thing?
Because they were put in as different elements in different spots, and it's the construction that's most consistent with the patent specification. It's what the applicant said. Get it to the hard drive virus-free. You can only do that one way. One way. Now, Your Honor, I'd like to just address this issue of divided infringement for a moment.
Well, I mean, before you move on to that, did you argue to the district court that our earlier decisions were not binding, were not stare decisis?
I argued to the district court that they were binding on the term storage. Symantec made the same argument in Hillgrave 2 on remand. They said the only term construed by this court was storage and storage medium. And actually, the district court relied on them, relied on their argument denying Hillgrave's summary judgment. Symantec said these are the only terms construed, and
you didn't argue to the district court that our earlier claim construction wasn't binding?
No. We argued on the word storage that it was binding, but not on screening the data as it was being transferred.
Okay.
An essential requirement of the patent that can't just be subsumed by storage. Divided infringement.
Could you address briefly the inventorship issue?
Yes, certainly. The facts here are undisputed. One of the named inventors, Gray, was having a problem. His customers were concerned about computer viruses. Gray's looking for a solution. He calls Mr. Levin because he's an expert in the field. He wrote the computer virus handbook. Levin, as per his declaration, tells him how to solve the problem, the method for screening the data in transit. Gray records in his notebook that he had a conversation with Levin. Mind you, not a lot of details are there, but Symantec and Gray say this is his conception document. He never disclosed to the patent office his conversation with Levin. Levin remembers his conversation vividly, even though 14 years have passed. No one has rebutted anything he said to Gray. And they had plenty of opportunity to bring Gray in or anybody else to rebut him, and they didn't.
As I understand your argument, is that not only is there testimony from Levin that supports his position, but it's corroborated by Gray's notes, to the extent that those notes say anything, but probably more significantly by the circumstantial evidence that the district court really didn't give any weight to.
That's correct, including Gray's testimony himself, where he says that he was asked, are any of the entries on this notebook page, do they concern the patent? And he said, yeah, the conversation with Levin. That's what he said. That was the only entry on that page, Your Honor, that he said concerned the patent. And then if you look at Gray's history,
well, I don't understand that last name. Say that again.
Gray was asked at his deposition, Your Honor. There's four entries on this February 12th notebook entry. Do any of them relate to the patent? He goes, yes, in a conversation with Mr. Levin.
Where does he say that?
We cite it in our brief. I don't have the site offhand, but we do say it in our statement of facts, and it's part of the appendix.
I'd like you to give me that cite in your rebuttal.
Certainly, Your Honor. And the district court made credibility determinations. He just assumed Gray's declaration that he's an inventor was true. And he totally discounted what Levin had to say, probably because of the passage of time. But those are issues that should be heard by the trier of fact. They should be heard by the jury. They're not right for summary judgment. And that's
the
issue.
Is it the testimony you were referring to, the testimony at appendix page 10,066?
It's
in volume 2.
Yes, okay, you said. Yes, you said item 3 on this page has something to do with the 776 patent. Is that correct? And could you describe what this is about, entry number 3? And previous to that, he said that entry number 3 had to do with the 776 patent. He talks about this phone call with Levin, and he says, I don't remember what we talked about, basically.
Of course, that's an Levin. Make a contribution. Maybe Gray had the idea and discussed it with Levin and just made a note that it had something to do with it. Those notes don't add a whole lot.
Well, we're not asking for summary judgment on inventorship. We're saying that summary judgment against us shouldn't have been granted because Levin has a detailed. Levin never saw this patent. He never saw this document. And he filed his detailed declaration recalling this phone call and how he told Gray the intransit screening method, how it could solve this problem. No one came into rebuttal. Mr. Levin should be heard at a trial. That's our point.
What about his testimony on 893, in which there's a statement to the effect that you consider yourself an inventor of the 776 patent, Mr. Levin? No, why not? And there was an objection because then you finally answered it, no, because I wasn't the first person to think of it.
He goes on to state that he believed it was obvious. That's why he said he wasn't an inventor. He didn't think he was an inventor because he didn't think there was an invention in the first place. And what Symantec tried to do in the district court is say, you know, basically that he had to be a patent lawyer, conversant in patent law, and know the legal requirements for inventorship. He didn't have to do that. Levin's declaration of what was said to Gray is unrebutted. When he said, I don't think I'm an inventor, because he didn't think there was an invention. But if there is one, he made a contribution, or else the jury should decide if he did. If it pleased the court, I'd really like to address the infringement issue. Under BMC Resources, this case fits right within it. CA only manufactures software. They do not perform every step of the claim process, no matter what construction this court's adopt.
Does that contention apply to all three products?
All the products, all of them. Symantec has to show control. That's what the case says. And that's not the first case to hold that. This court in BMC Resources harkened back to
What part of the method isn't performed by the software itself? The downloading?
The downloading, the transferring, any of that stuff. All CA does is make the software and sell it. They don't do it. They don't control what happens from the source computer. They don't control what happens in the destination computer.
What we're talking about is the software that you supply does something.
All it does is screen.
So what's missing? Downloading?
The rest of the claim. Transferring from a source storage medium to a destination medium, the rest of it. Storing doesn't store.
But isn't it your intention that your customers apply that method? That's what the software is for.
We have to talk about direct infringement first before you even get to inducement. There's no control over our customers. Sending out literature describing products is not control.
So you think your customers don't download stuff? I mean, what's going on? I'm having trouble understanding this.
They haven't proved. The district court said there's no evidence of direct infringement.
Well,
And even if
they don't download? I mean, is your contention there's no proof that the customers download?
There's no third-party discovery on anything.
I mean, but that's part of the point you're making. There's no proof that the customers download stuff?
Not in accordance with the method. There are different ways. Here, we have claim construction issues on what a destination storage means. It could be one thing or another thing. We have claim construction issues on what a computer or computer system is. It could be one thing or another thing. We have claim construction issues on what in transit means. It could be one thing or it could be subsumed by storage. They have to show control. Even if, the way I read BMC Resources, even if a customer performed the other parts of the method, you still have to show that we controlled to show direct infringement files.
Control?
That's what the case says, control or direct.
I would have thought that all that need be proven is that it was within your contemplation that they would do this and that you encouraged them.
That isn't the way I read the case. That's the inducement element. You have to show direct infringement, and this court held that no court.
But what's control have to do with direct infringement?
Because where you have a divided infringement issue, where the company being accused did not perform every step in the process, and steps are performed by other third parties, the patent owner has to show that the accused control those other steps, control those third parties. And there's no evidence of that.
Well, no, this is a different situation because you've got a consumer that is going to use the software for the very purpose that it's intended. And there's no question here, it seems to me, that the software is going to be used for that purpose. There's nothing else you can do with it.
But that's like saying the claim is just screening data. There are other limitations in those claims. There's 20 claims in this patent with all sorts of limitations. And Symantec's trying to reduce the claim to screening data.
But where there's really no question that the software will perform those steps as it is intended to be used and as you are marketing the product to be used, then that's enough to establish direct infringement. Then the only question is inducement.
No, what it has to show, that the method is carried out. The only thing CA software does is screen data after the entirety of it has been written to the hard drive. And you have to show control.
Control of data.
For example, the cross method.
Let's assume that the customers are directly infringing the patent using your software, okay? Does there have to be some showing of control? The question then becomes inducement, right?
Not the BMC Resources case concerned the issue of direct infringement. That's
what
the case.
So what is
the
contention is not that Computer Associates is directly infringing. The contention is the customer is directly infringing. So what is in determining whether it's a direct infringement by the customer, what does CA's control over the customer have to do with this?
The customer, there's no evidence in the district court. The district court made a finding.
That's a different question.
Okay. The district court made a finding that there's no evidence of direct infringement. So it didn't even get to the part about whether our brochures were enough for inducement or things like that. Didn't even get there. So without any evidence of direct infringement, you can't even do an inducement analysis. The record can't change. The district court record can't change. There is no evidence.
Is there any other way in which the accused software could be used other than to perform all of the steps recited?
Sure. We have a gateway product where the software is on an intermediate server. The district court construed computer and computer systems so as to exclude intermediate servers. And they cited Symantec's own expert as support for that construction. So that's another element that we don't satisfy. If somebody downloads
program off the internet and says that their destination storage medium is a thumb drive. That's not using the method in accordance with the court's claim construction.
Mr. Nicodemus, you have gone all over your time. Give me 2 minutes to go over your cross appeal. You want to discuss it?
Just the inequitable conduct issue, Your Honor, very, very briefly. There's enough here that that it should not have been decided on summary judgment. It should have been submitted to the jury. Most prominently, Gray says in his commercial success declaration filed in 92 that he had 10 years of experience. 10 years of experience in computer software and computer software communications, and based on that experience, he was intimately familiar with the art. He also said that he is the one who developed the algorithm for in-transit screening. At his deposition, he said the opposite. He said, I'm not...
Where does he say he developed the algorithm?
He said, I set out to develop an algorithm, paragraph 4, that would facilitate the in-transit screening.
That's not quite the same thing as saying he developed the algorithm.
Well, when he said, well, he didn't say he did it with anybody else. He said, I set out to develop. And he filed this declaration to try to convince the patent office that he was one of skill in the art. He could opine on the issues of patentability. He can say why his was better, why his was different, why his was unique, and what his did. So, Wakelin was the inventor who developed the algorithm. They didn't submit a declaration to Wakelin or Heil, who was another technical person. He's the guy who came up with the finite state machine. They submitted a declaration of Gray. And he has no experience in the industry. He's a marketing person. Precedent of this court says if you misrepresent your credentials, that could be inequitable conduct. This was in a declaration he filed, which makes it per se material. And at his deposition, he contradicted himself. So that he should be put on the witness stand and made to account for it. He didn't file a declaration in this case saying, well, this is what I meant, to try to explain his 1992 declaration. He didn't do anything. And the district court basically said these things are irrelevant. They're not irrelevant. The question is, would a reasonable examiner want to know what Gray said in his deposition, whether he didn't develop the algorithm, whether he didn't even know what an algorithm was, whether he couldn't program a computer, he couldn't read source code, whether he was a marketing person, whether he was not familiar with the state of the art of anything. That's what he said.
That's all on the record.
That's correct.
That's fine.
That was the last point I wanted to make, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the point I want to make on the infringement issue that was just discussed, to just clear up a misunderstanding, CA's counsel said that this argument they made, it was actually the causing limitation that was at issue below in the summary judgment, and that was the basis for the district court summary judgment. It was only with respect to the EAD product, specifically for purposes of the motion, recognizing that if we go back down, there'll be a case and have to be proof of infringement and those kinds of things. I understand all that. But if you look at page 140 of the appendix, the district court specifically found with respect to ARCSER that CA, for purposes of the motion, did not contest that limitation for purposes of ARCSER. So ARCSER was not an issue on this causing limitation, which was the basis of the district court's misunderstanding of what the issue was before. And the infringement issue, what the district court decided was because there was a question as to whether the EAV product of CA performed the causing step, that in order for there to be an infringement case, what the district court said is that CA's customers performing that step has to be equivalent to CA performing that step, which can't be the case because that would eviscerate the claim element, which frankly is it's a misunderstanding of the law. What the district court did is took some doctrinal equivalence law and tried to apply that to an indirect infringement theory. As I understood your Honor's questioning of CA's counsel, the issue with respect to EAD only, respect to ARCSER, with respect to content inspection, it's not an issue. But with respect to the EAV software only, the question simply is whether EAB's, or excuse me, CA's customers for EAB perform all the steps of the method. It's not a control issue. There's proof under the Moleculon case, circumstantial proof, certainly, which is fine. And even under this court's recent decision, I realized the facts came up the other way in the Apple Brands case, where there was a determination when that's the only way that the product is used to perform those steps, that can be sufficient proof as well. So,
what about the inventorship issue? The district court granted summary judgment on the grounds of lack of cooperation rather than on the ground that Levin contradicted himself. And that latter argument that you're making seems to me pretty weak, because he did say, I didn't contribute to it because I thought it wasn't new. So, on the corroboration question, why isn't the testimony of 1066 sufficient to get to the jury on the corroboration question?
Because the corroboration has to be as to the specific contribution that was made. And that's there is nothing in the record to show the specific contribution. Mr. Levin to this day has never said what his specific contribution to the claimed invention was. So
wasn't his alleged contribution to screen before the virus reaches the destination?
No. In fact, he never testified to that. What he testified to is that there was a conversation. Nobody disputes that.
Yeah, but he testified what he told Gray in the course of the conversation. And he did make some suggestions about adjusting the existing software to make it do screening before storage. Right?
Correct. That's in the declaration. You're correct.
Right. And so what is item 3 here, number 3, that he's talking about on 1066? Is that the idea of screening before storage?
I apologize, but I don't actually have that citation in front of me, so I don't know specifically, but I do know the declaration generally speaking.
But you could have seen both of you. You're supposed to come here. I know the record. I understand. Better than we did. That's what you're supposed to be.
I understand that. I'm not going to misrepresent my knowledge with respect to the specific paragraph that you're citing here. There was a point made that by CA's counsel that Mr. Gray never contradicted Mr. Levin's subsequent statements that, in fact, well, yes, I was an inventor and I did contribute, albeit he never says specifically what he contributed. That's it. Mr. Gray testified at his deposition that Mr. Levin didn't contribute anything. So there has been hit the statement by Mr. Gray that, in fact, that's not the case. That's at page 12, 3, 5, 4, and 55 of the appendix. I understand that inventorship can be shown through circumstantial evidence under the case law, but again, it has to be circumstantial evidence as to what the specific contribution is. So similar, in the Gemstar case, there's a question of whether one of the engineers who was named in the product literature and talked about in the product literature was, he was claiming to be, that he should have been named inventor on the patent, and that wasn't the case. And the decision went against him, and the reason why it went against him is, yes, there can be circumstantial evidence to show that, but there has to be evidence to show what it is that you contributed, what you specifically contributed.
Well, why do you send your judgment, then? Why don't let it go to the jury at that point?
It's a matter of sufficient evidence. There isn't any evidence in the record to corroborate what specifically it is that Mr. Levin allegedly contributed.
Is that really a jury question to make that determination rather than the judge and the summary judgment?
Well, a little bit on summary judgment, I guess you can always say that. And so the answer is, how much is there sufficient evidence in the record, of whether it be circumstantial or direct, that a reasonable jury could conclude, again, here it has to be by clear and convincing evidence, that there is sufficient proof such that they could conclude that
Mr. Levin did contribute specifically to the claimed invention, and that's what I believe is lacking. There is no such evidence that rises to that level, but the ultimate question I won't deny is a factual question. And I don't know if there's any more questions on the in-transit limitation. That's obviously, from our perspective, you know, I'm not pulling punches or hiding anything. That is the main issue with respect to Symantec. And the, you know, the statement that CA's argument to say, well, under Symantec's, you have to give the preamble a different construction, a different meaning, otherwise the storage limitation doesn't mean anything. The reality is that argument is exactly backward and proves our point, because the storage limitation is what this court has, in the body of the claim, has previously construed. If you accept CA's argument that the statement in the preamble that names the method requires screening before the data is written, then the storage element that this court has previously construed, specifically in Hillgrade 2 and Hillgrade 1, I recognize it was an agreed upon construction that was accepted, is meaningless. Because that would necessarily, if you screen one under CA's argument before the data is written, it will necessarily be before it's stored. So there's no reason for that limitation. And in fact, it's a contradictory limitation. The only way you can read everything that was put into this path at the same time to overcome the prior art consistently is under our construction, where the language of the preamble merely states what the transfer period is, and the body of the claim delineates the bookends, when it starts and when it ends. And that's exactly how it's distinguished from the prior art.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think one of you found the form. Thank you. In one sense, counsel is right. In transit is a major issue. The patent only discloses one method. It says that's the invention. But
this is your cross appeal.
My cross appeal. One issue on my cross appeal. Counsel said that Mr. Gray testified that Levin contributed nothing. I can go to my brief and pull all the sites, but Mr. Gray's testimony was not that. Depending on what deposition and what case he gave, he'd say, I don't know, I can't tell you, I don't think so. This is an issue for the jury. Let the jury sort it out. Assess the credibility of Gray and Levin and decide who did what.
All rise. The honorable court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10:00 a.m.